What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Market moving insight and analysis. Join Jim Cramer, David Faber, and me, Carl Quintanilla, on the opening bell hour of CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
Good Friday morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm David Faber with Leslie Picker and Scott Wapner. We are live from Post 9 at the New York Stock Exchange. Carl and Jim both have this Friday morning off. Let's give you a look at futures. Of course, you heard Becky talking about we're looking for a higher open. We were at this time yesterday, and in fact, we got it, but things sort of changed as the day went along. Let's start with our roadmap, though, and those stocks that are in rally mode. The S&P would be on pace for what would be its third straight week of gains. This is Investors Digest, the latest batch of inflation data.
Plus, Intel returning to profitability after two quarters of losses, sending shares surging in the pre-market.
And the Bank of Japan shocking the global financial markets with its latest policy tweak. We've got the details.
We'll start with the markets on this last trading day of the week. That much I know.
Beyond that,
I don't really have a lot, so I'm glad you two are here to help.
At least you got that one.
Okay. Yeah, I got that one.
It's all downhill.
We did not.
Yesterday was Thursday.
The statistically irrelevant Dow did not manage its 14-day streak to break the 1897 record. So there's that, unfortunately. And then obviously we had that very strong start yesterday in the NASDAQ, Scott. When you were on air later in the day, though, things had changed significantly.
Well, you had the story out of Japan that BOJ was going to sort of tweak its policy, maybe tolerate higher rates. Our rates moved up a little bit, and then the market ended up selling off. But this morning, it's all about the PCE, and rates are down. The market likes it because it really didn't upset the story that and this path that we think we're on. Guys, that the Fed is, maybe takes another pause at the next meeting, and then there's only 1 in 3 chance right now of a November hike. So nothing that happened this morning in the data says, oh, wow, okay, maybe we need to rethink what the path is again for the Fed.
Which is kind of the mindset and the fragility of the mindset currently is that any kind of volatility on either front could upset that. But, if you've got something that's kind of just a little bit off from estimates, a little bit in line with estimates, that is seen as a positive thing. Obviously, it's been a very big week for central bank news, for earnings news, the BOJ news this morning. Very, very interesting and in terms of what it means for U.S. bond markets because they're the largest foreign owners of U.S. debt. So there's some thought that maybe there could be some repatriation if yields are allowed to go higher over in Japan. And what would that mean from kind of the Japanese selling off U.S. debt and putting their capital to work instead in their home country?
Of course, as you say, Leslie, it's been a big week for earnings, and today is no exception. We'll get to as many as we can, of course, P&G and Ford, Exxon, Chevron, Intel, T-Mobile, amongst some of the bigger names. But, Scott, we've come off what would seem to be a pretty good week in terms of at least the big mega cap. Now, we've yet to hear from Amazon and Apple.
Amazon and Apple next week.
Yeah, that's next week. But, of course, we have digested Alphabet. Market liked it. 29% operating margin. Meta yesterday had a very warm reception, although as the day went on, the stock did not perform as well as it had in the earliest going. Microsoft, a bit less so, although generally speaking, not a bad quarter. I'm just curious to sort of what your take is on what we've seen, on what the market has done with it. A lot of people yesterday, for example, still talking about Meta's multiple, given what expects to be accelerating revenue growth into the mid to high teens, and yet it trades below the market multiple.
It's the knock you hear about the mega caps almost across the board. You look at Apple, what is Apple, 31 times at this point, maybe Microsoft's 33. But yet they keep, for the most part, living up to the hype. And, what the relationship is between where interest rates have gone and how these stocks have done, higher rates haven't really been able to knock these stocks off of the mantle, so to speak. And Michael Hartnett over at Bank of America today says real rates are not high enough yet, Leslie, to do that.
Yeah.
To what he says, pop the AI bubble. Now, you can debate whether there is, in fact, an AI bubble or not. But nothing this week that we've gotten from an earnings perspective upsets the story in what has been a more broad market. That's the whole reason we're talking about the Dow at 13.
Well, also,
right? The streak was ended at 13, but the reason you got to 13 is because the market itself had broadened.
Also, I don't know, maybe when I think about bubble-ish companies, I think of unprofitable ones. So if you've got high rates, but profitable companies that are driving that excitement to the upside in AI, how does that factor in? Just kind of looking at earnings season, we're actually halfway through. And it's been a really good earnings season just in terms of beating consensus. 82% of reports have beat consensus on the bottom line. That's better than the 77% five-year average and up 5 points just from last week alone. So this week has been a key driver here, especially with some of those big tech names. But companies are exceeding expectations by a lesser margin than history. So by about 6.5% above expectations, below the 8.4% five-year average positive surprise rate. So more companies exceeding, but I think going into this earnings season, and you guys could probably comment on this as well, there's been just a lot of downward revisions, a lot of lowering of expectations. So the companies were beating and still not even beating by as wide of a margin as they have been historically.
Hence the market multiple has moved higher, and that seems to be a concern of any number of the strategists who come on who are perhaps less than constructive on the market from here. It's funny, Scott, I've heard a lot of them lately, and of course, they just kind of keep explaining themselves, and yet they haven't capitulated to a market that just kind of keeps powering and grinding higher.
They haven't capitulated, but in some respects, let's just take Mike Wilson, for example, over at Morgan Stanley. It's not like he's all of a sudden bullish, but he's realistic enough to say, as he did earlier in the week, I think at the very beginning of the week, we're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We did not see earnings holding up to the degree in which they have. We didn't see the AI bubble. What some would say is a bubble, but the AI boom is better said. To the degree that's carried the market higher in the Magnificent Seven stocks either. So it's kind of like if you see the writing on the wall, you may ignore it for as long as you can ignore it, but at some point you have to acknowledge, the call was wrong. Now, whether those types of strategists actually get more bullish remains to be seen, as in some cases the narrative has changed and that the market's been in this uptrend. You have a growing number of people who are now on the bullish side, which makes other folks nervous, see too many people joining the bullish brigade, but nonetheless, at least some of the more negative strategists have kind of seen the light.
I wonder what those types of, capitulations say about just the overall kind of market sentiment. We just got through bank earnings, or at least for the big universals, and trading activity was really muted, and a lot of people blame that just on the fact that there's such lack of conviction about what's going to happen with the economy, what's going to happen with the direction of the markets, especially in the FIC markets, fixed income currencies and commodities. And so, I think part of that has to do with just the strategist even being like, well, this is not what I expected to happen. This is not what my regressions were telling me, but here we are.
Indeed, here we are. And as we said, of course, Scott, we have a lot of earnings to get to as well this morning, including Exxon. Chevron had already pre-released. Ford, certainly something we may want to talk about as well.
We start with oil, though. Oil's on track for its fifth week of gains, David. It plays right to you on Exxon, as the drop in oil prices is obviously hurting the profits of Exxon and Chevron. Profits were down 56% at Exxon. Profits were down 48%. At Chevron. Now, you know Exxon better than anybody from the doc you did. Obviously, there's a good correlation there between what's been happening in oil, notwithstanding the last 4 weeks. But in a bigger picture, oil prices down hurts the profitability of big oil.
No doubt. But they're still doing just fine.
Yes, they are, as they usually do.
And both Darren Woods, who joined Squawk Box this morning, and Mike Wirth, who joined us, if you recall, earlier in the week. We got a preview of Chevron's numbers. Remember when they extended Mr. Wirth's contract for a period of years beyond what had been the retirement age at Chevron, and they announced the departure of longtime CEO Pierre Breber. We got a preview of that. But both Woods and Wirth talking about a world that still needs an awful lot of what they're producing. Take a listen.
I think this year we're going to see record high oil demand. I expect that to be then next year even be higher. So certainly in the short to medium term, there continues to be a significant demand for oil and the products that come from oil, primarily because the world is growing and economic prosperity is improving all across the world.
course, Mike Wirth also making the point when we spoke to him earlier this week. EVs are here, mm-hmm. and over time, yes, that will dampen consumption of gasoline. But chemicals, plastics, ammonia, think about fertilizer. Mm-hmm. There are so many other uses for these products. And that's when you hear Woods talking about things like that. It's not just, of course, for automobiles or worth. And that's why you're still, and those who are very focused on climate change, clearly disappointed to hear the idea that we're going to produce more than we ever have.
Mm-hmm. But interestingly, just kind of looking at a superlative here, a third straight drop in profit. That's the longest decline since the 2014-2016 oil crash. So despite kind of relative stability on the oil front, I mean, obviously declines in the last 5 weeks or so, weaker nat gas prices, though, and shrinking returns from fuel sales. So the question, I think, remains when this kind of turns around for them. Is next quarter going to be the
Yeah, but they're still generating change. So much cash at this point.
I think they return like $8 billion to
shareholders. And they're returning a lot. They're doing some of it. You know, I mean, they are doing some deals. Exxon did the deal with Denbury a couple of weeks ago. Chevron has done some deals in the Permian as well, increasing their footprint there. So, you know, they are putting some of it at least back into trying to enhance production. But, of course, return of capital has been a key part really of this sector now for many years in terms of don't put a lot of it back towards future production as much as give it back to us.
Mm. How much do you think we should be thinking about when it comes to the energy complex and what oil's doing as it relates to these questions about China? David, and where the recovery really is in terms of a global demand perspective, which could add to, you know, this fifth week of gains we're seeing in oil, but take it on a much longer trajectory back up if you think that recovery is going to start to take hold, because it's been so uneven and not anything close to, I think, what people expected it would be at this particular time.
No, I mean, we talk about it a lot, of course, the expected recovery after COVID there, and it has not emerged the way it was anticipated in mm-hmm. China. Youth unemployment, of course, we talk about a great deal, being over 20%. Hard to believe that number in many ways.
Yeah.
And always tough to get a full read on the Chinese economy. They did say they grew at, 5.2 or something along those lines, or that's where the World Bank still is in terms of their estimates as well. But you're right, Scott, and I don't know what that, you know, they're using a lot of Russian oil, of course, as you know. So that's helping fuel, sadly, the money that Putin needs to continue to wage war in Ukraine. But it is an important point as well, because if they do come back on as strong as they have in the past, conceivably that will increase consumption worldwide.
Yeah. We've seen a little bit of that in the luxury names over the course of the week. And, you know, the U.S. was actually the underperforming market, with the exception being Hermès,
yes.
Which showed sales and profit jumping thanks to Birkin bags. If you can believe, there's much demand for, I don't even know how much they cost, like $30,000?
It has been
same
interesting.
Same as a car?
I mean, Hermes, why are you looking at us?
I'm looking at you.
Yeah, I've never even seen a Birkin bag, let alone.
I've seen it in the movies.
Yeah, you don't own one?
Oh, I do not know.
What do they go for? Do you know?
I think it's like the price of a car, like $10,000, they're saying in my ear. Okay.
I think they go higher than that, though, right?
Well, they have high resale value, so I guess it depends on if you buy it new.
There you go.
It's
somebody just said $10,000 in my ear. I think that's low.
I think it's low, too. I think they were talking like a few years ago. Yeah. Higher.
Yeah. Way low.
Higher.
People, they don't know.
I was thinking the price of the car.
Our executive, senior executive producer has no idea. What would he know about Birkin bags? My producer, however, does know, and she told me much higher.
Should we, since we're talking about higher prices, maybe we should talk about Procter & Gamble.
Let's do it.
Bring it back.
Those prices have stuck, Carl.
Yeah.
Scott.
Talk about the range, right?
Yeah.
Of Birkin bags down to Procter & Gamble
down to
products.
Diapers.
But seriously, they have pricing power, and they continue to flex that muscle. And that is one reason why you had the earnings, which were in their margins, which were strong, and the reason why the stock looks the way it does, David.
Operating cash flow, $16.8 billion, net earnings, $14.7 billion. That's fiscal year number. That's a full year number for the company. But again, because they also did report their full fiscal year 2023 net sales number of $82 billion. And that was up 2%. But you're right, organic sales and being pushed by price, they are not seeing people trade down to the extent that there had been a view there would. Unilever also, Leslie was quite good on the branded products and not necessarily pushing down. We heard from Kenview a few weeks ago, different world to some extent, but nonetheless also saying that people largely stuck with the big branded names that come in more expensive. So
Mondelez, yeah. Higher prices there too.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can flex it if you have the ability to raise prices. And then your margins will stay intact. So, you know, I guess you could make the argument that the Fed is winning on inflation. There still is inflation in the system.
Sure.
For these kinds of companies that have the ability to raise prices.
But when do they normalize, especially if consumer behavior hasn't changed at all? They have no incentive to go back to...
Not until people really start not buying their products.
Exactly.
Which hasn't occurred. They're not buying cognac, though, as we know
from
LVMH's in the United States. The cognac sales have fallen off. Scott's not serving it any longer at the end of his dinner parties.
Nope.
Trading cognac for Birkins.
Tequila.
And
That's all day long.
Yeah.
I'm going to wait till after dinner for that.
All right, still to come. We're going to break down Intel's big quarter, sending shares higher in the pre-market. Let's take a look at futures as well. You did have that good inflation data today. PCE was in line, and the stock market looks pretty good. 15 minutes before the open, Dow would open higher by 166, S&P by 30. More Squawk on the Street is straight ahead.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. What makes eHarmony so special? You. No, really. The profiles and conversations are different on eHarmony, and that's what makes it great. eHarmony's compatibility quiz brings out everyone's personality on their profile and highlights similarities on your discovery page, so it's even easier to start a conversation that actually goes somewhere. So what are you waiting for? Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tastytrading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
Intel shares, take a look. They are going to be up over 6%, it would appear. This after the company had an earnings beat, at least to the analysts who follow it. It returned to profitability. This after two straight quarters in which the company actually lost money. Now, not to get overly excited, non-GAAP net income was down 52% from a year ago. Revenues down 15%. And any number of their business segments, including client computing, down 11.5%, data center and AI, 13.9%. It's just...
All business segments, there was weakness,
yes,
right?
Yes, it's just they did better than had been anticipated. And so it is being rewarded. Go back 20 years, as I've asked us to do, and you can sort of see. That puts it in perspective. That's 10, and then we'll go back 20, and that's not much. That's the fraying of a great, great American company right there. Mm. One of the key decisions along the way, perhaps. I think it was Paul Ottolini when he said... Nah, Steve Jobs, that's okay. We don't need to provide chips to your iPhone. We'll be fine.
If there's a positive take, maybe it's, maybe you can say PCs have bottomed.
Yep.
And that's what they're going to hang on. And then it raises issues, too, about the story of the day, which we started with as we talk about big tech and looking in next week, AI. And whether, Intel can be a real player in this new world of AI. As it's been all about NVIDIA and then in some respects Broadcom. They cite competitive pressures, not necessarily related to AI, but AMD comes to mind. So there's been every reason to talk about all of these other names and not necessarily Intel. That's part of the problem that they have to figure out how to overcome.
They do. And part of that has to do with just their manufacturing capacity, which they've been advancing. I think they're still a few years away from where they want to be on that front. But some of the commentary from Pat Gelsinger has been that, things will improve in the second half of the year, especially for personal computers where they play heavily. And so I think the market, it's the kind of stock where the market's really just looking for some good news on that front.
You can take a look there, even just over, that's just a year, in terms of how NVIDIA has distanced itself from every other company, of course. And there's a few years to take a look. You look at Intel there. I mean... when you look at Intel over the last 20 years, you see the decline of American chip manufacturing, basically.
Yeah.
And to your point, they missed a couple of cycles on nanometers. Taiwan Semi became the world's preeminent manufacturer of the most advanced chips. Intel was, and then it wasn't.
Apple.
And of course,
make Apple,
Apple
right, making
Apple
its own
makes
chips.
The M2 for its MacBooks and the M1. They make their own chips. Samsung, obviously, as well. And many others. Listen, there are all sorts of different chips for different types of uses. But, I mean, we grew up in a world where Andy Grove, I remember, you know, back in the early days when I was at Siemens, Andy Grove was the king. And Intel was, without a doubt, the most preeminent American, one of the most preeminent American technology companies, if not. It's hard to bring that back.
Well, you know.
ChipSack may help.
Yeah. And Gelsinger thinks he's the right guy to do it. You know, the market hasn't necessarily given him the benefit of the doubt beyond that very first day. You remember when he was, you know, named as he was coming back?
Yes.
The stock popped on these great expectations that, you know, Gelsinger was going to return this company, to David's point, to prosperity. And we're still waiting.
Man, these things take a while.
Oh, it takes a
these
while.
Turnaround
it's
going
to take a long time just to build the fabs alone that they plan to build in the United States, in
exactly.
part with help from the CHIPS Act. And
the R&D
and
aspect. And, yeah. I mean, there's
finding
a long
the workers,
lead time.
Finding the workers is not
yes.
easy either.
Yeah.
TSMC, which is trying to do that in Arizona, will tell you as well. It's just not that easy.
Yeah. Well, we've got a ton of other earnings to hit with names like Roku, Mondelez, and Sweetgreen on the move. Taking a look at futures at this hour in the green. You can see there Dow is indicated to open about 170 points higher this morning. More Squawk on the Street when we return.
The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tasty Trade. Tasty Trade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tasty Trade. Join the club, genius. Tasty Trading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
While EV adoption is still growing, the paradigm has shifted. EV price premiums over internal combustion vehicles fell more than $3,000 in the second quarter and nearly $5,000 in the first half. We expect the EV market to remain volatile until the winners and losers shake out.
All right, let's take a look at shares of Ford. That was Jim Farley, the company's CEO, of course, on the conference call after earnings. You can see not much of a move there. You know, Jonas, who follows the company closely, of course, and Morgan Stanley, the analyst, a tale of two auto companies. ICE beats, but Scott, they talk about EV retreating. And obviously he talked about some of the challenges and opportunities that they see in that market, such an important one for them as they retool the company.
Yeah.
So they cut the, right, they just cut the F-150 Lightning by 10 grand. Mm-hmm. They're trying to stimulate sales. It's interesting to hear Farley just, you know, say the market's going to be volatile until the winners and losers shake out. You could make the argument that it's already shaken out.
Yep.
And that the winner is Tesla and the loser is everybody else. Because it's been able to distance itself to some degree. You know, Musk putting growth over profitability the way he has by simply cutting prices, David, to the degree they have repeatedly, and he may not be done, to continue to spur sales. You look at the stock performances we have on here, what Tesla, you know, over a long, you know, Tesla, this maybe is obviously not representative of what the stocks have done versus one another. Ford shares have, for the most part, not been able to get out of their own way. Tesla shares have had a remarkable, there's a better representation on the screen of what I'm talking about.
The winning effect.
Winners, losers. There is a winner, and there are many losers to date, to this point. Whether the GMs and the Fords and some of these others can make up some of the slack is the question.
Let's get that opening bell here. You can take a look at the real-time exchange. Could be a lot more green on that one. All said and done, of course, given the look at futures before we have the opening. Here's the big board. Haymaker acquisition for four. Celebrating its recent listing over at the NASDAQ. Sadot Group, that's an agri-food supply chain provider. Agri-food supply chain provider, of course.
Sure.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
But going back to the conversation of Ford, you know, as things shake out, they can't afford to not be in this space, right? If this is where consumers are going, they can't just pivot completely and be like, we're not we're not going to do EVs at all. But I think the pricing dynamic is an interesting one that really does need to be sorted out, and who has the ability to charge more for these vehicles, who does need to maintain kind of a, you know, a Tesla model of cutting prices to get more scale, more share amid all of this competition. It's really interesting here, especially as, you know, Adam Jonas says they expect major changes in Ford's EV strategy may be necessary. Is that price? Is that production? Is that the vehicles themselves to make them potentially more appealing to consumers? Is that the manufacturing process? I mean, all of these different levers that can be toggled. But as you mentioned, Scott, time is of the essence. I mean, you can't just do this over the period of years. The chips are falling now, so you have to kind of claim your rightful place in the EV history world.
You know, I think what was most, in some ways, telling from the Ford call is he talks about their strategy at Ford to have an 8% margin on EVs. And to your point, Scott, and to the pricing power that Tesla has, an 8%, I mean, that shows the difference there. They were coming down from what were the margins originally? As much as 15%, maybe more? At Tesla, 20%.
I mean, ultimately, you're going to...
And, you know, they have that pricing power in part because you're talking about companies that are one day hoping to get a margin that Tesla's far exceeded.
You're going to have to ask your question. Ask the question, I guess, is to, you know, the consumer who is even interested in an EV, are they interested in anything other than a Tesla if they're interested in an EV?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the Farleys and the Mary Barras of the world, General Motors, obviously, CEO, are trying to figure out. As to your point, Les, I mean, they have no choice but to invest in that part of their business. But it's a hard world to be in when, you know, Musk continues to eat everybody else's lunch because he has an ability to not care about profitability in the way that some of these other CEOs don't have a choice. Investors don't care whether Musk weighs on profitability or not. They care about the growth. Are investors in General Motors and Ford willing to overlook profitability in EVs the way they are in Tesla? I don't know.
Well, and how much brand affinity is there if you've owned GM cars your whole life? If you've owned Ford cars your whole life, do you one day pivot to a Tesla, or do you stick with that brand just because that's what you know where the dealerships are, you know where to get it serviced? I don't know how strong those bonds really are, especially when you're looking at just such a different model, you know, in terms of EVs and the other things that people look for. It's just not your traditional car shopping experience.
Yep. David's going through a press release. He'll be back with us in a second. Take a look. Let's note the market as well, because we've gotten out of the gates pretty well, right? The Dow streak was ended at 13 in a row as a, you know, yields move higher yesterday. A lot of eyes were on the Bank of Japan and this policy tweak, as it's being called. But nonetheless, we're higher across the board. Dow is up just about 200 points. Earnings, Leslie, as we've been going through this morning and what happened this week, pretty good. Across the board, certainly better than feared. There were some questions as to whether better than feared was going to be good enough, whether the market was going to be receptive enough to better than feared. It certainly seems like that narrative that's been in the market isn't ready to change yet.
Earnings leading the Dow to the upside here. You've got Intel up 4%, Procter & Gamble up 2%. Largely a lot of green on the screen for those names. You know, the biggest laggards are Cisco, Chevron, which, as David pointed out, you know, pre-announced and is down only about 0.74%. So nothing crazy. But a lot of green on the screen for a Friday. Of course, we've got that PCE data, what the Bank of Japan did, markets really distilling that and how it interplays with the U.S. markets.
What
as well.
I want to talk to you about too, Les, is right in your wheelhouse is the financials. You've got these new capital requirements, some questions about whether you're going to have the same degree of buybacks that you've gotten as well. Financials have done next to nothing this week. Now, over a month, they've been one of the best performing sectors, up 7%. They really got, actually, the best performing sector over a one-month period of time, financials.
Yeah.
Because the stocks reacted very positively to earnings in a way in prior quarters they haven't.
It was the banks within the financials, which I think a lot of people were surprised about, because talking about negative earnings revisions, the banks saw a lot of those revisions come down over the last few months in the wake of what happened in March and April with the banking turmoil. The biggest winners, if you look at kind of the bank stocks that have done the best, especially since then, It's basically the banks that acquired assets of the failed banks.
JP Morgan?
JP Morgan. It's New York Community Bancorp, which I don't know if you saw this, but they got an upgrade today on the prospect. They acquired the Signature assets on the prospect of them just dominating more share as a result of that. And those who acquired Silicon Valley Bank as well.
Fabes, you good?
Yeah, I was trying to review the Charter release, one of the larger cable companies in the country there. We're taking a look at...
That's New York Community Bancorp, what I was just talking about.
Got it. Because we also got T-Mobile. Let's dive into these two if we can. T-Mobile, of course. And again, we've been talking in various ways about Tesla versus Ford, Intel's decline over a period of years, and then there's Verizon and AT&T and the competition they've faced from the likes of this company, which has the largest market cap of any of the wireless companies out there, by a pretty substantial margin over Verizon. I can remember when they passed it, it was either earlier this year or last year, but you can take a look. And it continues at this point. Postpaid net account additions, 299,000. Postpaid net customer additions, 1.6. Million. Churn was 0.77% churn in the industry overall. Verizon churn was very low too. They added 9,000 postpaid. AT&T had a pretty good quarter on that front as well, although neither stock responded very well to earnings. There is that concern about the lead-wrapped cables most heavily when it comes to AT&T, although they have responded to it, less so for Verizon, and virtually nil for T-Mobile. It's just not a concern. There's no legacy business there in terms of having this stuff buried in the ground. So you can take a look at AT&T shares, which have just been disastrous over the last year at this point. Not so for T-Mobile, of course, but again, not a great response in the stock market. Stock hasn't done much to anything this year. Let's call it flat, but flat is not bad for this sector,
yeah,
given you've had declines of AT&T of 20%, Verizon of 14%. The continued competition, obviously, is not just limited to the three companies, but includes our parent company, Comcast, which we talked about yesterday, added, 340,000 or so, I think, wireless subscribers. And for its part, Charter adds 648,000 mobile lines. That's both residential and small and medium business mobile lines. You may see the ads everywhere for Spectrum. 6.6 million now they have total mobile lines at Charter. And this is the evolving competition we've talked about, the MVNO that they both have with Verizon to resell essentially the Verizon network, has proved to be an important competitive help to both Comcast and Charter. Charter shares overall up a bit, not nearly the reaction that our parent company Comcast got yesterday, and actually seeing a bit of follow through today as well after it bested expectations. Charter, for its part, had second quarter adjusted EBITDA, $5.5 billion. That was up 0.2%. And top line there as well, up just ever so slightly. Second quarter revenues, $13.7 billion, up 0.5%. But we talk so often about this. Video customers, they just continue to be in seminal decline. They're giving year-over-year numbers here. So a year ago, they had total video customers at Charter of 15.495 million. Now they have 14.7. So that just gives you a sense as to what's going on June 30, 2022 versus June 30, 2023. And that's only increasing in terms of accelerating, in terms of cord cutting, which, of course, we talk about all the time, what it means for the likes of a Disney, for a Paramount, for
Roku?
An NBC
Roku.
Universal,
for a Roku.
Maybe for a Roku.
Up 16% as we speak, by the way.
Yeah. Again, there it may be a function of just not as bad a quarter as people had anticipated, I guess, Scott, but I don't have all the specifics on Roku. You can see what's happened to that stock.
The only thing I see is a narrower than expected loss to your point of being, you know, better than feared. But better than feared in this kind of market is good enough in some cases, and maybe that's the overarching theme of earnings season as a whole.
Yeah.
Just better than feared. And you could say that about the prior earnings season and the one before that, because you don't have a rally the likes of which we've had in the markets overall unless you have put in the books better than feared earnings seasons, plural.
Well, and of course investors try and kind of garner a read-through from advertising from the companies that have already reported. Roku can showcase that they're doing a little bit better than that. You get a 16% pop. But there are so many interesting dynamics going on in that space right now, especially with, you know, the writers and the actor strike and the ability to continue churning out content in the current environment. You know, the market just had a lot of kind of negativity surrounding that name that just better than feared, as you mentioned, enough to get a 16% pop today.
M&A, as you both know, has been relatively muted throughout much of this year. But one area that we continue to see are these big premium purchases by, let's call it Big Pharma. In this case, not quite as big. It's Biogen on the buy side. It's a company called Reata Pharmaceuticals on the sell side here. We're talking about rare diseases, product development, global commercialization. They're dealing here with what they call serious neurologic diseases. They do have an FDA-approved, first and only approved treatment for something called Friedreich's ataxia in the U.S. Biogen's buying them. The premium is quite significant, $172.50. The stock was trading about $109 yesterday. And the expectation is it will, of course, boost that rare disease portfolio. Biogen's been in focus in part because of their continued efforts to try to come up with significant advancements in terms of combating Alzheimer's, with some success, previously not as much. But here again, $172.50. They've already got the vote of 36% voting power of certain stock agreements they already have from stockholders there. Question, of course, in many of these becomes antitrust. You don't expect to see it. You just never know when the, you know, Amgen Horizon, nobody expected the FTC was going to have any issues whatsoever. In fact, they have. They're scheduled to go to court perhaps in September. We'll see whether there's a settlement that takes place prior to that. And Lina Khan, who joined us last week here, was also at the Economic Club of New York earlier this week. Answering questions, I think it was from Peter Orszag, but she spoke specifically and sort of in an interesting way about this very subject of Big Pharma buying smaller competitors. Take a listen.
We've also heard from some capital allocators about the ways in which having a smaller number of exit paths or just a handful of companies that are going to provide that commercialization, that there is a worry that that in and of itself is also dampening the valuation or kind of impeding their ability to actually negotiate on the deal terms. And so even if at the end of the day, you're going to have some of those acquisitions for that commercialization path, more competition and more jostling among the potential buyers, we think, is ultimately also going to be better for the innovators themselves, as well as ultimately for, you know, the trajectory of innovation.
Essentially seems to be saying she'd like to see more competition amongst Big Pharma to buy these, although my sense is, having followed it pretty closely in some cases, not this one, that there's a plenty of competition amongst the Pfizers, the Mercks, the Bristol-Myers, the Lillies, you know, you go on and on from there, the Glaxos, for these very companies that are at the forefront of innovating. But when they get to that point where they've hit commercialization, they don't have the sales forces, they don't have the ability to actually bring the thing to market in an effective way, and that's the plan. Plan is to do some really good science, find some really great compounds, develop them, get them to phase two, maybe phase three, and then sell to Big Pharma, a la what they're doing here with Reata.
And this is an all-cash deal. They're actually issuing debt, long-term debt in this market, to buy the company at a significant premium, which you really don't hear about much these days. They're using cash on hand, a combination of cash on hand and financing in the markets to do this. And so, you know, you've got the regulatory uncertainty, financing maybe a less of an uncertainty there. But, you know, big deals are hard to come by this year and last year.
They are. I am hearing generally a lot more conversation. I think I've said this a number of times from the M&A professionals that I tend to speak to with somewhat of a regular basis. So there is some hope for later in the year that we may start to see stuff. But again, that lady you just heard from, Lina Khan, she looms large in the thinking of many who are considering deal making. And her counterpart at the DOJ, Jonathan Kanner, who we often mention as well, who runs antitrust at that regulator. They loom large because even if you think you can win in court, the idea that you might have to go to court in the first place may mean let's not bother.
Unless you think you can win, and maybe more do think that they can win, even if they have to go that road. I mean, the FTC, David, to me, continues to, they keep talking tough, but their track record doesn't necessarily back up the bark.
But the idea is talk tough and try to just stop people from even thinking about doing something, as opposed to and freeze the market. I think that is as much part of the strategy, Scott, as anything else. But you're right. Now, the question, though, still becomes, all right, you're willing to go to court because we think you can win, but that's going to be 18 months. Who knows? Could be even 2 years. You really want to take that amount of time. That still is something that's difficult for some CEOs to process as something worth doing.
Yeah, so much is on hold when you're in the process of closing a merger in those 18 months. You know, you miss out on other strategic investments you could be doing. You miss out on certain hires because you're just in limbo with regard to what your future looks like. You miss out on certain strategy decisions. You can't make as many decisions in terms of supply chain changes or R&D. So, you know, that's kind of why you see such a freeze on the market, is because people don't want to, you know, go through that opportunity cost of 18 months of just lost time, as well as, of course, litigation expense, which,
yep,
you know, 18
no
months.
And distraction, as we say. Scott, I'm taking a look at megacap tech, and it's leading the way yet again, with the NASDAQ resuming what had been that significant rise yesterday. Very similar percentage increase yesterday at this time, only to obviously retreat as the day went on.
Yeah.
But Apple, Meta, Alphabet, Amazon, Microsoft, all up. More than 1.5%.
No direct correlation, but enough of one, I suppose, that across the entire curve, yields are negative today. So that's not upsetting, that story. Again, we're looking ahead to next week, to David's point, with MegaCap and Apple and Amazon, which are going to be the last of the two of the MegaCap tech stocks to report. The only one that really didn't do much this week, I don't know what it's up for the week or down, is Microsoft. But otherwise, it's been pretty good across the board in all of those names.
Yeah, no, that's a great point here. And just kind of looking at the Treasury complex as well, because we were kind of anticipating or looking into some moves on that front with the BOJ news and what it meant for some repatriation of cash, potentially selling some of, you know, U.S. government debt.
Yeah.
In favor of kind of the...
You mentioned the Treasury complex. That actually heads us to the bond report, Leslie. Well done. Good segue.
You know, that's why they pay me the big bucks for my Birkin bags.
Oh, yeah, those Birkin bags, which we know now go up to $300,000 each. All right, let's take a look at how Treasuries are faring this morning. You can see that 2-year at 4.893, 10-year 3.979% is what you get if you lend your money for 10 years to the U.S. government. We're back after this.
Show you what the markets are doing. Dow and S&P on track for their third week in a row of gains. It's been, in many respects, a slow grind higher. Dow, as we said, you know, up every day this week before yesterday, and it's still only up 0.67%, 0.67% on the Dow, which is good for 173. A reminder later, don't miss Wharton Professor Jeremy Siegel. He'll be with me on Closing Bell today at 3 o'clock Eastern Time. Get his take on what's going on with the Fed and where he thinks the market can go in the weeks ahead.
$1 billion plus deals in private equity have been scarce recently. According to S&P, 33 deals of that size have been announced so far this year, down from 96% last year. Deal value is down 62% year over year in the second quarter. And with the dearth of deals, fundraising has also slowed dramatically. It's down 20% to the lowest level in 8 years. But I recently sat down with KKR's global head of private equity, Pete Stavros, for a Delivering Alpha newsletter, which you can subscribe to using that QR code on your screen there. And he said now is, quote, a great time to do deals.
The data has shown over decades now, we got a lot of data on private equity outcomes, when the public markets are more volatile and when credit markets are tighter, better return deals are done. I mean, that's the history. And it's logical, because purchase prices are constrained because you can't borrow as much, and the money you can borrow is more expensive. This is the time to be leaning in.
Of course, the flip side is it's harder to exit, and sometimes it can be harder to convince a seller at a lower valuation. But Stavros says those expectations are finally starting to adjust, as there is a pretty long lag in the private markets relative to the public ones. David.
Yeah, an important point he makes there, of course, again, that you can do your best deals in an environment like this, but you need prices to come down, and that adjustment period takes some period of time. Sellers, they can be kind of stuck. They look at, you know, the peer group, and especially when you got a rally like you do in the NASDAQ right now in particular.
Yeah.
It can make it hard for those comparisons, so it's a It's a standoff.
It's the epitome of financial psychology right here, because people say, well, I was able to make 5X last year, or 2 years ago most likely. Now I'm only down to 3 or 4. Do I want to sell, or do I want to just hang tight until things, you know, normalize, if that's the view that they think it is going to normalize? There's also the financing component, as we talked about earlier, you know, and just the fundraising. If you don't have as much dry powder out there, then...
Although a lot of them do, because they haven't done as many deals over the last few years.
They're sitting
on it. Even prior to the move up in rates, there was a feeling that things were too expensive. So, you know, I do continue to hear we're going to see a lot more activity in PE. That may just be a hope instead of a reality. We'll see.
We heard about this a little bit on the Goldman call. I think was that last week? I'm getting my weeks confused. Where they do expect that to pick back up, because PE deals are a big driver of their investment banking business as well.
Leslie. Stocks have done well.
Yes.
Over a month.
Yes.
KKR up 8%, Blackstone 14%, TPG 8%.
And they're beneficiaries of those capital rules as well, because the, you know, the business moves to the non-bank financials.
Yep, private markets.
Mm-hmm.
Scott, Leslie, thank you so much for helping me through this hour.
Thank
in particular,
you.
Just being here in general, being you.
Thank you, David.
You're
Anytime,
welcome.
David.
After the break, we're going to turn back to some of today's big earnings movers. We're back in two.
You've been listening to The Opening Bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
All opinions expressed by the Squawk on the Street participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, or their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information Squawk on the Street participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and/or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Squawk on the Street disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Squawk on the Street disclaimer.
If your small business has a problem, you could say,
"Ugh, just my luck."
But you should say,
"Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there."
And we'll help get you back in business. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.